headlines. Iran blames U.S. excessive demands and refusal to lift anti-Tehran sanctions for the standstill in the talks to revive the 2015 nuclear deal. Iraqi security sources say two rockets have hit Baghdad's fortified green zone, which houses the U.S. embassy. And Russia reports 799 coronavirus-related deaths, an all-time high it has reached three times in the last month. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story, Iran's ambassador to the Vienna-based international organizations has outlined some of the U.S. and its allies' excessive demands in talks on reviving the 2015 nuclear deal. Kazim Gharibabadi said the U.S. has demanded talks on Iran's regional influence and its missile program conditional for lifting sanctions and the full implementation of the nuclear deal. He noted that the U.S. refusal to lift arms embargo on Iran is in clear contradiction with Security Council Resolution 2231. The Iranian diplomat said Washington has also refused to remove more than 500 individuals and entities blacklisted during the former U.S. administration. Gharibabadi added the U.S. has also failed to give assurances that it would not repeat the behavior of the previous administration in case of the full implementation of the deal. Iran and the remaining signatories to the nuclear deal have been holding talks in Vienna since May. The outgoing administration of Iranian President Hassan Rouhani has met with Iran's leader, who had some observations regarding its performance, especially on the nuclear deal. The leader's statement spelled an air of pessimism about whether the talks would be successful or not. He said the next administration should not repeat the mistakes made by the current one.
Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has said that one key lesson for future administrations to learn from the experience gained during the tenure of outgoing President Hassan Rouhani is that there is no benefit in putting one's trust in the West. Ayatollah Khamenei made the remarks in a meeting with the members of President Rouhani's administration. He said it was manifested during the tenure of this administration that nothing can be gained from putting one's trust in the West. The leader added that domestic programs should in no way be tied to Western states under any circumstances due to the proven failure of such an approach.
Iran's ballistic missile program and Iran's regional role have nothing to do with the original JCPOA or United Nations Security Council Resolution 2231. They are simply irrelevant. And so to the extent that the United States continues to attempt to utilize maximum pressure to bring in irrelevant issues such as ballistic missiles and Iran's regional role, I believe that we will very soon reach this impasse and that the Raisi administration will bring an end to this charade in Vienna.
Making a reference to the ongoing talks in Vienna, Austria, to revive the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, Ayatollah Khamenei acknowledged that endeavors made by Iranian diplomats, saying, however, that Americans insisted on their hostile stance against Iran and did not move even one step forward during the talks. The leader denounced the U.S. attempts to add new terms to the agreement to push Iran to begin talks on other issues. He said by adding such a clause, the Americans are seeking to gain an excuse for further meddlesome acts regarding Iran's missile program and regional issues.
If the talks in Vienna aren't already at an impasse, I believe that this is where we're going to be heading very soon if the United States continues to refuse to return to its responsibilities and its obligations under the agreement and instead attempts to utilize the illegal terrorist sanctions and maximum pressure campaign of the Trump regime in Vienna to acquire leverage over Iran in the negotiations, specifically regarding issues that have nothing to do with the JCPOA.
Ayatollah Khamenei drew attention to the fact that the U.S. has refused to provide Iran with a guarantee that it will not violate its commitments again. He noted that Washington will not shy away from violating its contractual commitments in the same manner that it did in 2018, a move that was completely costless for them.
Well, much of the topics covered by Iran's leader on the performance of President Hassan Rouhani and his administration, one of the views that he expressed was that the outgoing administration's experience proved that putting trust in the West did not work. He also referred to how the U.S. attempted to add new terms to the agreement to push Iran to begin talks on other issues like its missile program or regional activities.
Six rounds of negotiations have been held so far in the Austrian capital, Vienna, to revive the Iran nuclear deal, which has come to be known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA. 3 years ago, the U.S., under former President Donald Trump, withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal and branded what it called the maximum pressure campaign against Iran. Now President Joe Biden, who was the Vice President of the United States when the deal was inked, has promised to re-enter the JCPOA and abandon Trump's failed maximum pressure campaign.
Iran's position on the JCPOA and international law has been clear and consistent since the signing of the JCPOA in 2015. And so as such, I don't believe that an incoming Raisi administration or, frankly, any new incoming Iranian presidential administration would handle the current talks and negotiations any differently.
But so far, he's practically followed the footsteps of his predecessor. President-elect Ebrahim Raisi will be officially sworn in on August 5th. Raisi won the June 18 presidential election in a landslide victory, garnering over 18 million votes. It's widely believed that the foreign policy in Iran has a well-established and large-scale framework. When it comes to the issue of the Vienna talks, Iran's policies are not going to change. Therefore, no fundamental changes are expected in the negotiation process under the next administration. However, analysts believe the next administration needs to bolster the national position of Iran to successfully counter the bullying stance of the U.S. and its allies.
Muslims in the world are celebrating Eid al-Qadr. The festivity marks the appointment of Ali ibn Abi Talib as the first Shia imam. From Mashhad, our correspondent Yusuf Jalali has this report.
This is one of the most important festivities on the Islamic calendar. It's called Eid al-Qadr. It marks the beginning of Shia Islam. When 14 centuries ago, Prophet Muhammad introduced Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib as the next caliph of Muslims and their religious leader or imam. It's a tradition that Shia Muslims in Iran visit the shrine of Imam Reza in Mashhad on the eve of the festivity. While Eid al-Qadr is an occasion for celebration, Muslims also view it as a chance to learn more about who Imam Ali was and why he was appointed by the Prophet as the first Imam.
First of all, I would like to congratulate all Muslims on Eid al-Qadr. This happy occasion marks the day when our Prophet revealed to thousands of Muslims that his successor would be Imam Ali.
The Prophet chose Imam Ali as the Muslim's next leader because Imam Ali was the first man to become Muslim. And when Imam Ali ruled the Muslim world for 5 years, everyone realized that the Prophet was right about him, because during his rule, he rooted out poverty and social, ethnic, and sexual discrimination.
I come from Nigeria. I love my first Imam, and I believe everyone does. Every year, I come to this holy shrine of Imam Reza, who is one of Imam Ali's descendants, to celebrate Eid al-Qadr.
Every year on the occasion, the holy shrine of Imam Reza hosts millions of pilgrims who come to celebrate the festivity. But this year, the holy site is not as crowded as in the previous years, due to the coronavirus pandemic.
This is the second year in a row that the coronavirus pandemic has curtailed Eid al-Qadr ceremonies. But organizers have tried to keep the feast magnificent by admitting as many pilgrims as possible inside the holy shrine of Imam Reza, while observing health protocols.
Everything is prepared for a safe celebration, from social distancing to distribution of sanitary items to pilgrims.
In all the shrine's entrances, there are people tasked with distributing masks and disinfectants to pilgrims. Even inside the shrine, people who don't observe health standards are reminded to do so. Hopefully, we'll mark this great festivity safely.
Shia Muslims have 12 imams or religious leaders. The first was Imam Ali, and the last is Imam Mahdi, who is believed to be the prophesied savior of the world and is currently living in occultation. While all imams are equally revered among Muslims, Imam Ali holds a special position in Islam as the father of Shia Islam and the symbol of Islamic justice. Yusuf Jalali from the holy city of Mashhad.
Two rockets have hit the Iraqi capital's green zone, which houses government buildings and foreign diplomatic missions. An Iraqi security source said the rockets targeted the heavily fortified area early Thursday. The source added that the attack caused no casualties or damage. No group has claimed responsibility so far. The source of the rocket is not yet known either. Baghdad's Green Zone has been frequently targeted by rockets in the past few years. Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan has proposed the deployment of Russian forces along the country's border with Azerbaijan. Pashinyan said he's preparing to discuss the plan with Moscow. He said the move would allow work to be carried out on the demarcation and delimitation of the border without any risk of military confrontations. The remarks come amid renewed tensions between Azerbaijan and Armenia. On Thursday, the two countries accused each other of violating a truce they agreed on the previous day. The ceasefire was announced on Wednesday after one of the deadliest border incidents since last year's war over the Nagorno-Karabakh region and surrounding areas. Australia's biggest city, Sydney, has reported a record one-day rise in local COVID-19 cases despite an extended lockdown that is entering its sixth week. The state of New South Wales recorded 239 infections in the past 24 hours. State authorities also reported one more coronavirus fatality. The death toll from the current outbreak in the state has now risen to 13, and the overall infections to 921. Australia has been struggling to contain an outbreak of the highly infectious Delta variant in and around Sydney in recent weeks. The city has been under lockdown since late June. However, state authorities say further measures will be announced as current restrictions show little sign of efficiency. New South Wales police say they've asked for 300 military personnel to help enforce lockdown orders. And Russia has reported record high coronavirus deaths, registering 799 fatalities in the last 24 hours. This is the third time in the last 1 month Russia's COVID fatalities set a record. The country also confirmed more than 23,000 new infections during the same period. Russia's overall cases now stand at more than 6.2 million. While its deaths are nearing 157,000, authorities blame the surge on a more contagious Delta variant of the disease. However, despite the surge, no tough retractions are imposed across the country. Russia's vaccination campaign is also progressing slowly as there is a public reluctance to get vaccinated. Tunisia's presidency has now fired the head of the national television channel amid a political crisis sparked by the dismissal of the prime minister and the suspension of parliament. The sacking came after two guests were briefly banned from entering the channel's studios to take part in a program. The North African country has been facing its worst political crisis in a decade since Sunday. That's when President Reis Said dismissed Prime Minister Hicham Mashishi and froze the parliament for a month following mass demonstrations in several cities against the government's handling of the coronavirus and the economy. Said has also fired several other senior officials, including defense minister. The president's opponents accuse him of power grab, but Said says his moves are constitutional, aimed at saving the country from corruption and civil strife.
In his last speech to the Tunisian people, Said said his national responsibility required that he resort to Article 80 of the country's constitution. He stressed there is no room for tolerance when it comes to the looting of Tunisia's wealth, and that he will not leave the Tunisian state up for grabs. He slammed those who call his moves a coup d'etat, saying, quote, "Whoever claims that it is a coup, review your constitutional lessons."
"We have made these decisions until social peace returns to Tunisia and until we save the state. I'm warning anyone who thinks of resorting to weapons and firing a bullet that the armed forces will respond with bullets. I don't want a single drop of blood to be shed on Tunisian soil."
Tunisian citizens took to the streets rejoicing after the president's speech, while leaders of another party announced the rejection of the decision. Afterwards, army troops were deployed at the entrances to the capital, Tunis, and some of its main streets. Army forces also surrounded the state TV building, the parliament building, and the Tunisian government headquarters, preventing employees from entering them. Rashid Ghannouchi, the leader of the Nahda movement, his deputy, and a number of other lawmakers tried to reach parliament at 3 a.m. local time. Ghannouchi said he would call a citizen to challenge the president, but the army stationed outside the building prevented him from entering. In the morning, Rashid Ghannouchi staged a sit-in in front of the building. Meanwhile, supporters of the Ennahda party, which he leads, and supporters of the president assembled outside the building, throwing stones at each other.
What happened is to correct the course. We ask for accountability, first of all. Every person who attacked Tunisia must be held accountable.
I am not afraid of anything. I hope that God protects the president and we are with him. The people are with him. We tell him to go while we are with him. If he removes them, I will hold a religious party and fast for 3 days.
Everyone is waiting to see how events will unfold in Tunisia, while wondering what the motive behind the president's moves are. However, the most likely scenario, as many believe, is that President Saied wants to put the country's politics back on track. Amir Bouka, Tunis.
Elsewhere, the United Nations has called for the opening of critical aid routes in Ethiopia's war-torn Tigray, warning that the region risks running out of food supplies. The UN's humanitarian agency, OCHA, said in a statement that about 150 trucks with food and other supplies are being held in the city of Samarra. Access into the region was cut off last week after the only available route for aid delivery was made inaccessible following an attack on a World Food Program convoy. The region has been the scene of fighting between army forces and rebels. Hundreds of people have been killed and tens of thousands of others displaced since the conflict began last November. Clashes have erupted between anti-government protesters and police in the Colombian capital, Bogota, as unrest continues against a controversial tax reform bill and inequalities. The police used tear gas and water cannons to disperse the crowd that in turn threw rocks at law enforcers. The demonstrations mark a week-long pause in the unrest after dozens were arrested last Wednesday. The protest started in April as a pushback against a controversial tax reform bill, but faced police's violent crackdown. The rallies quickly turned into a broader movement against inequalities and police violence. More than 60 people have been killed during the protests. The government has now proposed a new tax reform plan, as well as a police reform bill to the Congress in a bid to subdue the unrest. And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Imam Khomeini guided the Iranian nation to determine their own fate, June 4, 2021. The televised speech delivered on June 4, 2021 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the 32nd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini. Greetings be upon him. The opponents of the Islamic Republic theory. Well, I should add that the theory had certain opponents. Both aspects of the issue, the Islamic aspect and the governance of Islam, and the popular and democratic aspect of the theory, had staunch opponents since the first day until today. In the present time, too, there are opponents who have certain viewpoints which I will point to. Number one, groups opposed to the authority of Islam, non-religious and religious secularists. There were unfaltering opponents against the idea that the country and that life in general should be managed according to Islamic values, principles, guidelines, and rules. Of course, not all of them were the same. Some were non-religious secularists who essentially believed that religion did not have such a right and that it was not in a position to concern itself in social and political matters of the country. And to lead the social and managerial system of the country. They believed that religion did not have such a function. According to this viewpoint, if someone believes in religion, they should know that religion is confined to saying daily prayers, fasting and taking care of personal affairs and the like. That is to say, they did not believe in the authority of religion in any way. Some of them even went as far as to believe that religion was opium for society and that it was harmful. Not only is it not beneficial, but it is also detrimental. These were one group of people opposed to the authority of Islam. But there was another group who believed in religion and who would try to defend it by saying that religion should not get involved in politics. That it should not get contaminated with politics, and that it should stand aside, preserve its holiness, and refuse to enter the arena of politics, which is an arena characterized by conflict, agitation, tension, and the like. If one wants to have a correct assessment of such individuals, one should say that they are religious secularists. They are religious, but in the reality, they are secular. To say it in simple terms, they do not at all believe in the involvement of religion in various aspects of life. They were antagonistic to the authority of Islam.
Thank you. A recent report by the Council on American-Islamic Relations shows anti-Muslim hate crimes have been on the rise in the United States this year. In a mid-year report, America's largest Muslim civil rights and advocacy organization detailed several instances of incidents including hate crimes, harassment, school bullying, discrimination, and hate speech. The Council documented a spike in anti-Muslim incidents in May and June, including four at mosques in May alone. These cases include vandalism, harassment towards women who wear a hijab or headscarf, and an attempt at stabbing. The spike coincided with Israel's 11-day war on the Gaza Strip that ended in a May 21st ceasefire and killed at least 250 Palestinians.
Well, there are a number of reasons. One, I think Donald Trump brought white nationalism and discrimination and even racism against Muslims, Arabs, and Palestinians into mainstream American political discourse. The other reason is, of course, that Israel launched an attack on Gaza in May of 2021. For 11 days, they bombed Gaza, and the militant groups in Gaza retaliated by firing rockets back into Israel.
The growing number of anti-Muslim hate incidents is drawing reactions from the U.S. Congress, too. Minnesota's Democratic Representative Ilhan Omar is leading a group of lawmakers calling on the U.S. President Joe Biden to nominate a special envoy to combat Islamophobia. The group has pointed to a rising number of individuals connected to larger white supremacist networks as perpetrators of Islamophobia. In a letter to U.S. State Secretary Antony Blinken, Congresswoman Ilhan Omar also referred to a June 6 car attack in Canada that killed four members of the same Muslim family.
Their lives were taken in a brutal, cowardly, and brazen act of violence. This killing was no accident. This was a terrorist attack motivated by hatred in the heart of one of our communities.
The National Council of Canadian Muslims urged Trudeau to address what it called the deep-seated systemic Islamophobia in the country, suggesting the appointment of a special envoy to confront the issue. Back in March, United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres cited a UN report which found that suspicion, discrimination, and outright hatred towards Muslims has risen to, quote, epidemic proportions.
Anti-Muslim bigotry is sadly in line with other distressing trends we are seeing globally. A resurgence in ethno-nationalism, neo-Nazism, stigma and hate speech targeting vulnerable populations, including Muslims, Jews, some minority Christian communities, as well as others.
But this is a relatively new phenomenon. The anti-Palestinian, anti-Arab, anti-Muslim view has had, you know, over 100 years of being part of the American psyche, and the pro-Israel forces, both the evangelical Christians and, of course, the Zionist Jews, have been very, very successful in getting their narrative accepted without question.
Limitations on Muslims sharing their beliefs, discrimination on receiving citizenship, and defaming Muslim communities were some manifestations of anti-Muslim biases the UN chief mentioned. Guterres added that Muslim women face triple levels of discrimination because of their gender, ethnicity, and faith, while the media and some persons in power have further compounded the stereotypes. The UN has called for the adoption of a global strategy that includes defeating all forms of violent ideologies. The question is how to execute such a strategy to make it appealing to all nations and people.
Tens of thousands of people in France, the UK, Italy, and Greece protested against coronavirus restrictions and mandatory vaccination policies, sparking clashes with police forces.
The European governments trying to force more unvaccinated people to receive their coronavirus shots by using sanctions. In France, nearly 160,000 people held nationwide protests against the implementation of a health pass by President Emmanuel Macron's government. Demonstrators slammed this policy by saying it's an attack on their liberty. Macron's health pass will ban access to restaurants and public spaces for unvaccinated people. During the rallies, tensions flared up as French anti-riot police fired tear gas toward protesters and used water cannons to disperse them. Several demonstrators have also been arrested. Elsewhere in Europe, thousands of Italians took to the streets of Rome, Naples, and Turin against the government's introduction of restrictions on unvaccinated people. Protesters chanted slogans such as "Freedom" and "Down with the dictatorship" over plans for a government certificate known as the Green Pass. The Green Pass is an extension of the EU's digital COVID certificate and will be required from August 6th to enter cinemas, museums, indoor swimming pools or sports stadiums, or eat indoors at restaurants. Thousands of people have also protested in London against what they describe as an erosion of their civil liberties. Demonstrators denounced the UK government's track and trace app, saying it limits their movements. Over 600,000 people are told to self-isolate in 1 week alone this month. The protests come a week after most coronavirus restrictions in England were lifted. Police used tear gas and water cannon to disperse more than 4,000 people who had gathered in central Athens to protest against mandatory COVID-19 vaccinations. Police sources claim that some protesters had thrown petrol bombs, prompting the police to respond with tear gas.
Certainly the lockdowns are making people unhappy. They're driving up unemployment. They're adding to general restlessness. But the problem is broader. I mean, I think people are upset about the poor economy, which is and slow economic growth, which is now in its 13th or 14th year.
Tens of thousands of Brazilians took to the streets and called for the impeachment of President Bolsonaro, who is facing increasing pressure as the pandemic exacts a devastating toll. The South American nation has been grappling with the world's second deadliest outbreak after the United States, with over 500,000 deaths. Demonstrators and police scuffled in Sao Paulo, with the smoke rising from tear gas canisters and flashbangs exploding. Bolsonaro has seen his popularity declining amid a Senate probe into corruption scandals tied to the purchase of COVID-19 vaccines. His approval rating is at a low record of 24%. Bolsonaro has been famously dismissive of the health crisis, the need to wear face masks, and lockdown measures to halt the spread of the virus. In Australia, protesters carried signs and banners reading "Wake up Australia" and "Drain the swamp." Demonstrators defied a month-long stay-at-home order by participating in the unauthorized march in Sydney. Nearly 60 attendees were arrested. Demonstrators clashed with police officers and threw projectiles at them. Authorities suggested that the COVID-related restrictions could remain in place until October.
People have lost faith in the political classes. They don't believe that the politicians in charge know what they're doing. They are quite angry and upset.
In many countries, anti-lockdown anger has merged with other grievances. Demonstrators criticize governments for suspending their right to protest because of the public health crisis. In addition, economic hardship and anxiety have further fueled public anger. According to a multi-agency United Nations report published last week, world hunger and malnutrition levels worsened dramatically last year, with most of the increase likely due to the coronavirus pandemic. The report said nearly 768 million people across the globe were undernourished in 2020, as the COVID-19 pandemic disrupted economies, job markets, and supply chains, as well as inflated food prices. The increase last year was equal to that of the previous 5 years combined. According to the report published by UN agencies including the Food and Agriculture Organization, the World Food Program, and the World Health Organization, Asia accounts for over half of all undernourished people globally, while Africa experienced the biggest spike. The report says more than 149 million children under 5 are estimated to be afflicted with stunted growth. That means their brains and bodies do not grow to their full potential. Also, children who suffer from chronic hunger are more likely to die before reaching maturity. However, food insecurity was already spreading across the globe before the pandemic due to the conflicts, economic recessions, and climate change. That's why nearly all low- and mid-income countries have experienced economic downturns in 2020. Low-income countries are more vulnerable to food price shocks in particular. While a surge in consumer food price inflation predates the pandemic, early lockdown measures and supply chain disruptions induced a spike in the prices. Also, higher transport costs increased consumer food inflation. Some experts believe that food scarcity will probably trigger social unrest and bring people out into the streets, which is likely to make the next few months unstable.
Well, I think that we have to understand that the food problem is not simply a result of the COVID problem, but it's also a profound problem as a result of climate change.
...2020 posed a serious blow to food security around the world, and the effects of the pandemic are expected to linger. In 2030, an estimated 30 million more people may face hunger than would have without the COVID-19 outbreak. Many factors affect food security around the world. Therefore, a food system approach is required to find effective solutions. A report by the State of Food Security and Nutrition in the World has recommended a number of actions to help prevent undernourishment. Those include increasing resiliency to conflict, climate change, and economic shocks, and sustainably ensuring access to affordable, nutritious food.
What we have to understand and what we should, as a society, be doing is encouraging increasing local trading systems and community-supported farming organizations such as those that exist around the world. It's called community-supporting agriculture, and they're very, very important because they provide a counterbalance to the increasing control and the lack of diversity that the large corporations are offering.
Food insecurity has been on the rise since the mid-2010s, especially in countries affected by conflict, climate extremes, economic downturns, or battling high inequality. The pandemic only exacerbated these existing challenges with significant negative effects, particularly for poor nations. Therefore, things are not going to change for better unless nations across the globe start working together.
On Friday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with visiting Iraqi Foreign Minister Fuad Hussein at the State Department. The meeting comes ahead of discussions on the role of U.S. military forces in Iraq. U.S. media have cited American officials as saying that the two countries are expected to formalize the end of Washington's combat mission in Iraq by the end of the year. That shift is reportedly planned to be announced on Monday when U.S. President Joe Biden hosts Iraqi Prime Minister at the White House. It could potentially mark a new chapter in the ties between the U.S. and Iraq, 18 years after Washington deployed its troops in the West Asian country. In an interview, the Iraqi foreign minister said the presence of American combat units in Iraq is unnecessary at this stage. He said what Iraq needs is cooperation in intelligence and training, as well as Air Force support. Earlier this week, Iraqi Prime Minister also stressed that American combat troops should leave his country.
I believe that the U.S. will not fully disengage from Iraq. My guess is they will leave some troops there in at least an advisory capacity, and also that they will augment the official military with private contractors. I don't expect the U.S. to totally leave Iraq.
In the meantime, resistance movements in Iraq say the presence of the U.S. forces in the Arab country will only benefit Israel. Anti-U.S. sentiments in Iraq have been running high since January 2020, when Washington assassinated Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani, along with the deputy commander of the PMU forces, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, in an airstrike near Baghdad airport. Following the assassination, the Iraqi parliament adopted a resolution that called on the government to end the presence of all foreign troops in the country. Iraqi resistance groups have pledged to take up arms against U.S. forces if Washington fails to comply with the parliamentary order. While the U.S. justifies its presence in Iraq with fight against Daesh, Iraqis are stressing that they don't need foreign troops and that they're capable of dealing with the issue themselves.
The U.S., at least at times, has assisted groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda, and I expect the U.S. to continue to do that. The reason the U.S. will stay in Iraq is to be able to have a base of operations from which to attack Iran and Syria and other countries and entities in the Middle East that the U.S. deems to be enemies.
On the other hand, the fact that apart from Daesh terrorists, the U.S. is the only perpetrator of attacks on Iraq's anti-terror popular mobilization units, which are legally incorporated as part of the Iraqi military, puts the U.S. claim of fighting terrorists in perspective.
Celebrates the divine appointment of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, the cousin and son-in-law of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, as Prophet Muhammad's vicegerent and successor. We here at Arabi English Radio congratulate all our Muslim listeners on the auspicious occasion of Eid al-Qadir.
Life and personality of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Month of Wilaya from IRIB English Radio. Sayyid Ali al-Musavi al-Jazairi.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Allahumma salla ala Sayyidina Muhammadin wa alihi al-Tahirin. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Dear brothers and sisters, أنا وعلي أبوا هذه الأمة, the Holy Messenger of God, Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam, said, Ali and I are the parents of this nation. We've already spoken about the root and origin of the position of the divine wilayah and authority, and we focused on the two fundamental crucial elements of love, and knowledge is this root and origin. The very elements that are anchored in the reality and identity of the father and mother, and cause the right and position of the divine wilayah and authority over their children. The very elements that exist in the reality of God Himself and cause His authority and wilayah over His creatures, including His worshippers and servants. But the question is this: who else possesses these two elements and qualifications to deserve the position of the divine wilayah and authority? As you remember, brothers and sisters, we said that we're faced with a chain of wilayah and authority. The first link of this chain is God Himself. The second link of this chain is His representatives, His apostles and messengers. And the third link of this chain is the inheritors and successors of God's prophets and messengers. The very fact that has been asserted and stated by the Holy Quran very clearly, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu ati'u Allah wa ati'u Rasul wa ulul amr minkum. O you who have faith, obey Allah, obey His messenger, and obey those vested with authority among you. Within this chain, the point on which we wanted to focus and concentrate was the first successor of the last messenger of God. This crucial status and position, the position of the first successor of the last messenger of God. In order to be able to answer a definite answer to this fundamental question, that can we accept the fact that anybody rather than Amir al-Mu'minin Ali ibn Abi Talib, the commander of the faithful, Ali, the son of Abu Talib, is deserved to sit in this status and position? The person who fought with the Holy Prophet, he struggled at every juncture, every turn, every war, every peace treaty. Ali ibn Abi Talib was always there at the very forefront defending the Holy Prophet. He remained defending the Holy Prophet at that critical moment when others fled from the battlefield in order to save their own lives, while the Holy Prophet was calling out their names, ordering them to stay and fight. The Holy Prophet always called out his name whenever he was in a trouble. Aina Saifi, where is my sword? They would say, your sword is in your hand, O the Holy Messenger of God. He would answer, no, I'm not talking about this sword. Aina Dar'i, where is my shield? There is your shield. He would say, no, I'm talking about something else. Aina Habibi Ali, where is my beloved, dear Ali? Anyway, I'm not going to delve into the virtues and perfection of this glorious, majestic character and personality, but rather I'm going to just focus a little bit on the second chain, on the second link of the chain of the divine wilayah and authority, God's prophets and apostles, in order to be able to get to know how the Holy Quran associates the two roots and origins of the position of divine wilayah and authority, I mean knowledge and love, to the personality and character of God's prophets and apostles. It's crystal clear that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala hasn't communicated to mankind directly by sending the divine revelation to every single one of them, but rather He has conveyed His message to us by means of some special intermediaries. They are the ones who have to undertake a very heavy and tough responsibility, because they have to convey the message, the divine message of God, to all other human beings free from all forms of illusion and error. So they have to be qualified enough to deserve the position of the authority of God among the creature of God, the creatures of God. So as you see, the very two elements of love and knowledge should be delegated to them in order to be able to undertake and to bear this heavy and tough responsibility. Inshallah, in the next episode, I'm going to bring up three Quranic instances which illustrate these two great elements and qualifications within the personality of God's prophets and apostles. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
We are approximately 4 kilometers from the Norwegian border. We want to go 5 kilometers inside Norway to buy fish. Norwegian fish is better than Swedish fish. My name is Ali Reza Bashiri. I was born in Ahwaz. I'm 52 and I live in Sweden with my daughter and grandson. Let's go make fish and see how it tastes. Welcome to the kingdom of Sweden. Do they have a king or a queen? I think I'm the king. This is my grandchild. I'm Daniel's grandfather. This is my only grandchild. I love him even more than my own daughter. I mean, my grandson comes first, then comes my daughter. Today, my daughter was going to make lunch. But I told her now that the movie is going to be screened in Iran, let the Iranian men know that when they come to Europe, they have to cook like women and they have to learn it.
It took me a while to learn. I don't like cooking very much.
Girls usually learn cooking from their mothers.
Yes, somehow, but I learned it from my father. Back then, I wanted him to come here. I wanted to have, what do you say for connection in Farsi?
She wanted to have somebody to rely on. But when she saw her mother for the first time, she said, I think I've seen her before.
Daniel.
When I was a child, I really liked to live somewhere in Scandinavia. When I studied geography at school, I really liked to see a Scandinavian country. It finally happened, and now I'm living here. Back then, I thought it would be so fascinating. But now I think wherever you go in the world, life is the same. When we got married, I told my wife I'd like to go abroad and live in another country. My wife was just 17 and myself around 22 to 23. I didn't have that much experience. We decided to go to Europe from Turkey. If you walk for 1 kilometer, you'll reach the Norwegian border.
Yes, then we'll be in Norway.
We went from Turkey to Germany and we sought asylum. We spent around 2 years in a refugee camp. The MKO members were very active there. they came into the camp and advertised for their organization. As a young man, and given my perception of the MKO, their propaganda made me think they were going to capture Tehran. Let's join them and not get left behind. They told me to go to Iraq with my wife. At that time, my daughter had just been born. She was only 4 months old. We decided that my wife, daughter, and I should move to Iraq. So we decided to go, but when we flew in Baghdad, I saw the true face of the organization. It was totally different than what I thought it was in Tehran and Germany. They told me I had to move to the men's camp and that my wife and child had to go to the women's camp. After 2 or 3 weeks, I told them I had a wife and kid.
Sorry, I should take Daniel to sleep.
After 2 or 3 weeks, I told them I had a wife and a child. Then they asked me where they were and said they would follow it up. What's her name? I said, Razia Khabbazan. They asked, what's your daughter's name? I said, Nushin Bashiri. They wrote it all down and told me they'd let me know. But after 2 weeks, I heard nothing. Then I asked them what had happened. What's wrong with us? You want to raise him the Norwegian way, but I prefer the Iranian style of parenting. The Iranian parent says, wait till your child is sleepy, then they will sleep on their own. But according to your method, the child must sleep on time.
My system is much better.
That's why we have differences. When I was doing military service, I was in the Hamza artillery unit. What did you do there? We fired artillery shells at the Iraqis. When I joined the MKO, I fired artillery shells at fellow Iranians. I never understood why we did so much of it. I got familiar with them very briefly. I had previously been exposed to a bit of propaganda in Germany. Considering my confusion in Germany and my sense of adventure, I decided to go to Iraq to see what was going on there. I had no idea I would get stuck there and frustrated too. We had to write a daily report about our mistakes during the day. Even if there was no mistake, we had to write something. We were forced to write about hypothetical things, so they let us go. For instance, I sometimes wrote, last night I dreamt of Ahwaz and my family. Then I realized that sapped my